Okay.
I better not try anything too ambitious. Is this working? No, it's not working either. Hello. Is it working? No. One, two, three, four, five. No, it's not working. Okay, so all this technology is great, yeah? There's so much that can go wrong. Thankfully, I have at least one projector working now, and I'll try and, if I stand here, I guess, I hope you can hear me. So, I think I've decided it's best, if it's okay, I'll keep the lighting like this, because it means it comes out better on the video. It means you can actually see me. Talking of which, I've now added a link to the website, a link which will take you to the Inf2A video page, and you can watch as many times as you like. You can watch the videos of the lectures up to now. There are still a few little technical problems. For instance, the link to the third lecture doesn't play the third lecture, it plays the second lecture, but we're working on things like that. They sort of work. The sound's quite good. You don't see much of what's written on the blackboard or anything like that, but it's sort of, well, they're there. So if you go to the lecture materials page, the individual links on to the lectures still aren't working, but there's one link at the top to a page which is managed externally, which should work. Okay, so you all know that tutorials start next week, so copies of the tutorial sheet for the first tutorial there, if anyone else wants to collect them. So enjoy those. Also, the lab sessions start next week, so hopefully you know when the lab sessions are or have a way to find out. So at some point during the next week, you should build into your timetable working through the first of the Python worksheets. That's of where you're meant to be up to, whether you can do that on your own or in a lab session if you want help. So hopefully all that will work. That might be all the announcements. Okay, so just to finish off a tiny bit from last time's lecture, and then that'll be kind of the end of the theory for a while, and then most of this lecture and the next lecture will be showing you some applications, some sort of interesting practical things you can do with all this theory. So what we were doing last time, we'd noticed that you can define languages via regular expressions, and it's quite easy to see that every language that can be defined by a regular expression is a regular language. And the converse is also true, but it's a bit harder to prove, so you can prove that if a language is a regular language, in the sense that there is an NFA for it, whatever, then you can construct a regular expression that will define the same language. And here's a construction I gave which showed you how you can prove that. So as we saw, this is a rather heavyweight construction because it involves defining a whole massive family of languages, so sort of three-dimensional array of languages, of regular expressions, one for every pair of states U and V, and every subset X. So although it's quite easy to see in principle that it'll always work, it'll always give you something, it's not terribly easy to carry this particular method out in practice. And here's an example of it, or a bit of it, carried out in practice for our old friend, the machine that accepts even numbers of zeros. And we get this rather messy regular expression down at the bottom. But it's not a terribly easy way of doing it. And I would probably never be so cruel as to ask anyone in an exam to actually use this method of constructing a regular expression. But it's the simplest one from the point of view of giving a proof. So what I want to do now is take you towards a somewhat more practical method, which is easier to apply in practice, although it's less clear conceptually that it's always going to work, although it will always work. Okay, so let's just think about what else we can do with these regular expressions. So we've already mentioned that one reason we want regular expressions is that they give us a sort of text-based way of specifying what a regular language is. And later in this lecture, I'll be talking about lots of things you can do on a computer involving processing of regular languages. And for those purposes, it's very convenient to be able to specify your language in a text-based way. So there'll be lots of regular expressions coming up in the applications. But there's another reason for wanting regular expressions, or another interesting thing about them, which is you can actually do algebra with them. So you can actually, just like at school, you learn to do algebra with addition and multiplication and variables and things like that. Once you've got a way of mathematical notation for writing regular expressions, you can apply various rules, and here's a load of rules that look like familiar sort of algebraic rules, for showing you that one regular expression is equivalent to another one in the sense that they define the same language. So, just for example, this plus, remember that corresponds to union of languages. So A plus, alpha plus, beta plus, gamma, whichever way you bracket it, that's the same language, because obviously the union of alpha, beta and gamma is the same whichever order you do it in. What else have we got? Alpha concatenated with beta plus gamma. This is language which consists of a string of alpha followed by either a string from beta or a string from gamma. And it's easy to see that that's the same way as that. So there's a whole load of laws like this. You don't need to kind of memorize all of them, but they're mostly pretty obvious. And you can get used to applying them. And you can use these to simplify down some possibly rather messy regular expression down to a simpler or more pleasant one. So a reason for wanting regular expressions, we can do algebra with them. We can use it as a way of proving that two languages are the same. So those are some rather simple rules. There's also slightly more complicated rules here. So here, rather than just talk about equality of languages, I've used this less than or equals sign here to mean, let's write this when we mean that the language defined by alpha is smaller than or the same as the language defined by beta. So beta is a sort of bigger language than alpha. And if you scratch your head for a moment, you can see that's exactly the same as saying that alpha plus beta is beta. I should point out, by the way, that plus behaves in a way you might not expect. So alpha plus alpha equals alpha. That's obvious in terms of what plus means here, but that's not it's not true in terms of what your plus might mean in other context. So here, yeah, if alpha plus beta is beta, that's the same as saying alpha is contained within beta. And then we've got these slightly funny looking laws here that say if we've got some condition with a gamma on both sides, and if gamma is such that alpha gamma, that gamma actually contains this language alpha gamma plus beta, then gamma must actually contain this language, which is any number of alphas plus beta. Again, it's obvious if you sort of scratch your head, but There's not much I can say to make it obvious that it doesn't confuse you even more. But perhaps what's slightly easier to understand is this related thing called Arden's rule, where we've got X here playing the role of this gamma. This is a useful rule because what you can do with this algebra is you can actually write equations down. If you've got some unknown regular language that you're interested in, you can call it X. You can write down an equation for X and then solve it, just the way you might try and solve equations in ordinary algebra. So if something we know about the language X is that it's equal to alpha X plus beta. So in other words, a string in X is either a string in the language for beta, or it's a string from alpha followed by another string in X. Okay. Then, so the smallest solution to this will be a solution where X is alpha star followed by beta. So if you think about it, this will mean that X must contain, if you sort of unroll this equation several times, you'll see that X must contain any string that's made up of any number of things from alpha followed by a thing from beta. And furthermore, if alpha has the property that the language associated with alpha doesn't contain the empty string, this is the only possible solution for that equation. I'm not going to prove this, but it's not too difficult to see. So that's a useful rule which we can use for solving equations, because here's an equation we're given and here's the solution, and under certain conditions it's the only solution. There's a further intriguing fact which is rather beyond the scope of this course, but these laws that I've given, these reasoning principles about regular expressions, the one on this slide and the ones on this slide, they are actually in principle all the reasoning principles you ever need. So they form, you might wonder whether, you could go on forever writing down reasoning principles like that, whether you reach a point where you can stop. So these are actually a complete set of reasoning principles, in the precise sense that if you have two regular expressions that do define the same language, then it's always possible to prove that they do using just the laws that I've given you. Okay, so you don't need any other laws in principle for showing equivalence of languages. So that's just a kind of reassuring fact that the laws we've got are always in principle enough, but I'm not going to show you why that's true. Okay. So let's use this algebra to give us a more practical method of converting a state machine, and let's suppose it's a DFA simplicity. We've got this DFA here. Let's try and convert it to a regular expression in a more practicable way than the way we gave before. And this is something you might actually want to do, right? Because if you're designing a state machine to do something, you might well find it easiest to design it by drawing a picture, because you can sort of look at the picture and see, then it goes here and then it does this, and get some intuition. But then you might want to actually use a tool to generate an implementation of that state machine, so you want some way of actually writing it down in text. So this is something you might actually want to do, to convert a diagrammatic state machine to a regular expression. So the idea is that for each of these states, let's give ourselves two variables here, a variable xp and a variable xq. And XP is going to mean the set of all strings that will take us from state P into an accepting state. And of course here, state P is itself the only accepting state. So XP is basically going to be the language defined by this whole thing of ways of getting from P to P in as many moves as you like. And XQ, likewise, is going to be the language consisting of strings that get you from Q into an accepting state. Again, in this case, necessarily P. So think of XP and XQ as two variables, and we don't know what either of these languages are, but we can write down some equations involving them. So for example, a string that gets you from XP to an accepting state, well, it's either going to be the empty string, because P is itself an accepting state, so you could stay where you are. But if you don't stay where you are, then you're going to either do a transition, and you're either going to do a one transition, to P. So your string could consist of a 1 followed by another string that takes you from P to an accepting state. Or you could do a 0 transition to Q. So your string could consist of a 0 followed by a string that gets you from Q to an accepting state. So whatever these languages XP and XQ are, we know that they're related like this, that XP is precisely this language defined here in terms of XP and XQ. And likewise, Q isn't an accepting state, so if we weren't going to get from Q to an accepting state, we're going to have to do a transition. We can either do a 1 transition back to Q itself, so a string that's a 1 followed by an accepting string from Q would do the trick, or a 0 transition followed by a string in XP would do the trick. So we've got two equations here, and so think of these now as a pair of simultaneous equations involving these two variables. And we're going to try and solve our simultaneous equations using this trick of Arden's rule that I showed you before. And in that way, hopefully, we'll get an actual regular expression. So look at this second equation, the equation for xq. We've got xq is something followed by xq plus something else. So on the previous slide, we had equations like this form. Equation with x where we've got an alpha followed by an x and then a beta. So the alpha here is just the 1 and the beta is this thing. Okay. So we've said that a solution to that is alpha star beta. So so in this case that'll be 1 star 0 xp. That's by Arden's rule. So we've now managed to express q in terms of xp. We've eliminated q from this equation. So now that we've got a way of expressing q in terms of the others, we can get rid of q, xq altogether, because we can rewrite the xp equation, just rewriting the xq there using what we've just found. And now we've got an equation which just involves xp. Okay? And then jiggling around with that by one of our algebraic laws, we've got this distributivity law. We can factor out the common XP here that occurs on the right-hand side of both of these. We've got 1 plus 0, 1 star 0, followed by XP, plus the empty string. And that, again, is in the form of alpha XP plus beta. So we can write that as alpha star beta. So we can write it as alpha star beta. But because the beta in this case is the empty string, we know that alpha star epsilon is the same as alpha star. That's also by a trivial rule. So by using Arden's rule again, we can get round to this formula, which was, you may recall, the fourth of the options on the clicker slide from the last time. So we can actually, and you can apply this method to machines with 3 states, as many as you like. And there's an example on the tutorial sheet which lets you do that. Okay? So this is a more practical method, and note we also end up with a slightly nicer regular expression at the end of it. Method for converting DFAs to regular expressions. Okay. And that's the end of that lecture. Sue. Lovely. This. Okay. So the last few lectures, I guess they've all been a bit theoretical, okay? And you might also feel that we've not been doing kind of real languages, because it's quite clear that all the languages we've looked at so far are a kind of baby talk, okay? Because not only are they just regular languages, but they've been regular languages over some pathetic little alphabet like just A and B, okay? And I'm afraid you'll find that the tutorial sheet as well, that's all about problems involving silly little theoretical toy languages like that. So by the time you've done that, you'll have ba 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 coming out your ears. Okay. So, but now I hope to show you that actually the theory that we've developed is actually powerful enough to do something interesting and practical. So we're moving more in the direction of real world problems. Okay. So this lecture, I'm going to talk about two kind of computer science-y applications of the theory of regular languages. And Tuesday's lecture next week, I'll be talking about a more natural language style application. So you can use this theory for lots of different things. So the two things I'm going to talk about here are problem of pattern matching, which is something you might have seen briefly before in Inf1, and the problem of lexical analysis, or lexing as it's known, which you may remember is the first stage in our language processing pipeline that we had for formal languages. So this is part of what a compiler is going to have to do, for instance, if you want to compile a Java program. So two somewhat separate topics. Okay. So a very important problem in practice is the problem of being able to search a large document, or a large file, or a large batch of documents for strings of a certain form. Okay. So this is a thing all sorts of people want to do, not only programmers, people who write web pages, but even people who are searching, like, you know, you're searching newspaper text or something for information about such and such. So obviously you can search for occurrences of a particular word you're interested in, but you can also do more sophisticated and more slightly more subtle things than that. And for this purpose, there's a bunch of utilities which exist on most systems in the Unix tradition. Certainly, for example, they're available on the Linux machines we have here. You might like to try them out. So there's a bunch of tools which are very widely used and which are known as the GREP tools. So GREP stands apparently for Global Regular Expression Print. I'm not quite sure I understand the phrase Global Regular Expression Print, but anyway, you can see that it's got regular expressions in it, so that's why we're interested in it. Okay. So this is an extremely powerful tool for searching for pulling information out of files, large batches of files. And in the hands of a practiced and experienced user, you know, you can do an awful lot with these tools. And they are among the most useful and powerful, they're thought to be among the most useful and powerful of all tools in Unix toolkit, for example. So there are lots of people who kind of swear by these tools. They're not just tools for their kind of a way of life. Give it to me in a form I can grep it in, you know. I'll say things like that. So and not only are they very powerful, but they make serious use of the theory of regular languages that we've just talked about. So it's a very nice application of theory to practice. So here's some typical uses of these tools. And you write something which looks quite geeky if you write it like this, but I guess that's part of why certain kinds of people enjoy it. You can make it look less geeky if you know lots of abbreviations and clever things, but you have to be even more geeky to know those. So anyway, the idea is you can type things like you can search your own files on the Linux machines here by typing to the Linux prompt, something like grep, and then a string like this which gives a pattern, and then the name of a file you want to search, and this will print out all lines in this document that contain a pattern of this kind. Okay, so I've noticed my first typo of the lecture. So there's supposed to be a pound symbol just there, right? Okay. So let me explain what this means. It's basically a regular expression. So there's supposed to be a pound symbol there, and then this means any one of the digits 0 to 9, okay? And this star is a Kleene star, so that means any number of times. So we can have any sequence of digits of any length there, okay? And then this dot means a dot, okay? An actual dot. And this backslash, that's an escape character to show that this dot really means a dot and it's not a sort of notational dot that's part of the language of regular expressions. You're used to that when you write strings, okay? If you want to write a string that happens to have a quote symbol in it, you need to write an escape backslash there to show that this is meant as a quote and is not closing off this quote here. Okay, so you know that.
So that's a similar thing here. That's an escape character, and this shows as a real dot. And then another instance of a character 0 to 9, and then another instance of a character 0 to 9. So this will match all strings like this. So this will pull out, if I'd had the pound sign there, okay, this will pull out from your document all the currencies of a price in pounds and pence of this form, okay? Here's another one, and you notice I'm using a slightly different command, egrep here. I'll tell you about that in a minute. This searches for all the currencies of the English word the, okay? So this means at the heart of it we've got the, okay? And this means you can have either a small t or a capital T there, okay? And then we want to make sure that we only get the words the by itself. We don't get words, we don't pick up words like then or other words that have a the in the beginning of them, okay? So we better ensure that there's a word boundary either side, okay? And then we ensure that there's a word boundary either side by saying, roughly we say that the symbol that occurs before the is not a letter. So here we've got the lowercase letters and the uppercase letters. And this caret symbol here, okay, means sort of negation. So this means not one of these, okay? So if we've got a symbol that's not one of these, followed by a the, with a small or large t, followed by another symbol that's not one of these, then we've got the word the. There's a bit more to it, because what if the occurs at the beginning of a line, so it's not preceded by a character of this kind? Well, this caret here means a start of line symbol, and this vertical line here means or, it's like union of languages, and this dollar here means end of line symbol, and this means or. So if we've got either the start of line or a non-letter character, followed by the, followed by a non-letter, either a non-letter character or the end of line,
then we've really got a the by itself.
Okay. So you write a geeky thing like that, and it will pull out all the thes you want. And you can do lots of other much more powerful things. Okay? So these grep tools, there are three of them, really. So there are three related commands called fgrep, grep itself, and egrep. And the differences between them basically are how powerful they are in terms of the generality of the sorts of search you want to do. Now, there's a trade-off here, because if you want to do a particularly simple kind of search, like just search for some literal string, okay, none of this clever pattern stuff, you may be able to use a more efficient algorithm to do that search, okay? Whereas if you want to search for something matching a complicated rogue rule expression, you might have to do something a bit less efficient. So roughly they're ranked like this. So fgrep searches just for fixed strings that you give it. And that uses a very efficient string matching algorithm. So that's a bit outside the scope of what we're talking about here. And then grep itself searches for strings that match certain kinds of patterns that you can give them, like these ones, like this one here. And those patterns are basically regular expressions, slightly disguised regular expressions, of a rather simple kind. And then we've got egrep, which is sort of extended grep, and this allows you a sort of a richer language of patterns. So this basically gives us the full power of regular expressions that we can match on. And so because we're talking about regular expressions, the last of these is the most interesting. So interesting to think a little bit about how this tool works. Okay. So I've mentioned we've got this geeky syntax for regular expressions. Okay. And it's geeky because it's hard to understand if you don't know it. But once you do, once you're fluent in it, you don't have to type very much to get it to do powerful stuff you want. So this is a syntax which is worth kind of absorbing, because it's used not just by the grep tools, but it's used quite widely in all sorts of string processing applications. So roughly the same, any kind of program or software that uses regular expressions in any way, it's likely to use some syntax pretty much like this for defining regular expressions. So for example, in Perl and in Python, and you'll see a bit of this, I think, when you use the NLTK toolkit, regular expressions are written in this sort of notation, only they're delimited by slashes rather than quotes. quotes, but apart from that, hey. So we can include ordinary characters that we want to appear, like in words like the. This is a choice of characters, so this would be like the regular language A plus B plus C in the mathematical notation. We can have any character in a range of characters, that's a range in the ASCII character set, where they're ordered in a certain way. And as mentioned, we've got this caret symbol which lets you say any character except the ones I want to talk about. And then here's where the notation starts to differ a bit from the normal mathematical notation, but it's just the way it is. So dot here is a special symbol which will match any single character at all. Okay, so it'll match just a single character, whatever it is. We've got some special symbols here for the beginning of line and the end of line. And it's clever enough to know that this caret on its own here is different from this caret that occurs inside these square brackets. Star is Kleene star, so that agrees with our mathematical notation. That's nice. That means zero or more occurrences of whatever's gone before it. So if I write A star, that means any number of A's. I could have something more complicated, stars. Question mark, that's a new thing. That means an optional occurrence of the preceding pattern. So A question mark would mean either an A or nothing. Okay. So that would be the same as writing A plus epsilon in our mathematical notation. Okay. So we're doing something you could do with regular expressions. No, because this is just at most one. At most one. So this means zero or one of A. Okay. A star means zero, one, or many of A. Okay. Now we've also got A plus, which means one or more of A. Okay. So that means at least one. This is a bit, and again, a place where the meaning of plus here, I'm afraid, differs from our mathematical use of plus. But the idea is, so L plus, you can think of as just a way of saying L star. Because this is basically the strings that are made up of at least one string from L. Okay? And just to point out that and we've also got, so the thing that's mathematically written as plus is here written as this vertical bar. And that gives you the choice or the union of two languages. So here, this would be either a string of any number of A's or a string of any number of B's. Okay. And I should point out these last three are the things that differentiate the E-grep pattern language from the ordinary grep ones. So these give you a bit more scope for more complicated things and give you the kind of full power of regular expressions. Okay. So it's worth picking up this language, and as I say, you can try, if you've got some text files on your own machine, you can try grepping them. You can read the manual pages for grep. You try grepping them to fish stuff out, just to practice doing this. It's quite useful stuff. Okay. Right, so let's think about how egrep works, because egrep's the most interesting one from our point of view. So what does it actually do? Well, you give it a pattern, a geeky pattern, and it's hopefully clear to you that these patterns, they basically are just regular expressions in a mild form of disguise. But basically, you can see that they're doing the job of regular expressions of a certain kind. So the machine can convert any pattern into a smallish NFA. And by smallish, I mean if you follow the method I discussed in the last lecture for converting regular expression to an NFA, you'll see that the size of the NFA doesn't essentially have to get any bigger than the size of the original pattern. Okay, so it's just by a constant factor that within a constant factor they're the same size. There's no kind of blow up in the language of state. So we've got a manageable NFA, okay, and we can use this NFA to look for occurrences of strings that match the regular expression we want. Okay, so we have a choice at this point. Do we try and convert our NFA into a DFA, okay, which will make it nice and efficient to run? Because with DFA, you just need to look up next symbol transition. You just look up, keep looking up in the transition tables. You can absolutely whip through it.
Or do we keep it as an NFA and try and execute it as an NFA, basically keeping track of all the states that we could possibly be in? So that latter option would basically be corresponding to doing the subset construction on DFA, on NFAs at runtime. Okay. So rather than compiling it in advance to a DFA, we just keep track of all the possible states we want to be in at runtime. So as I said, DFAs are faster to execute once you've got them, because there's only one state to keep track of. But the conversion of an NFA to a DFA itself takes time. So it's probably not going to be worth it unless you've got some really massive set of documents that you're going to want to search. Okay, you're just going to do it once. Probably be okay. And also, if you do this conversion, you might get this exponential blow up in the number of in the number of states. So you might not even have room if your NFA has 30 states or something like that. You might not even have room to store the DFA on your computer. So what in practice implementations of EGREP tend to do is a compromise between these, which is actually just to use a DFA, but just to build as much of the DFA as you need as you go along. So rather than construct the entire DFA of 2 to the n states, you just sort of lazily build it just as you're going along. You've got various states that you've visited before, and then if you try and jump to a new state that you haven't visited, you add that one into the transition table, and then you keep going. So you only construct transitions when they're needed. And this turns out to be nearly as fast in practice as just running a DFA, and it means we don't build a whole lot of states we never visit. Okay, so using this idea, this is what EGREP actually does. And notice we're making substantial use of our theory here, because we're using the idea of converting a regular expression to an NFA, and then we're using, at least implicitly, the idea of the subset construction of turning an NFA into a DFA, even though we don't actually build the whole of the DFA at once. That's what's making it work. So we're making substantial use of our theory to get something that's really useful in practice. So GREP, as I've said, that uses a slightly more restricted set of patterns. Roughly speaking, so we don't have the choice operator, the vertical bar. And that means generally there's going to be a bit less non-determinism around. Okay. Intuitively. And that means you can make things a bit more efficient if we don't have these operators around. But still, we're basically doing regular expression matching. So that's one application. Okay, so just as a little interlude before I go on to the other one, there are a few additional closure properties of regular languages enjoy that I haven't mentioned yet. So I've told you that regular languages are closed under unions. I haven't told you that they're closed under intersections, okay? So we've got two regular languages. The set of strings that's in both of them is again a regular language. You can probably convince yourself of that by taking a machine for each of these languages. And then if you form a new machine that's the product of these two machines, in other words, states of this new machine are going to be pairs of states, one from N1 and N2. That's like running N1 and N2 both at once on the same string. It's quite easy to cook up a machine that accepts exactly this language. And additionally to that, if L is regular, so is its complement. So we've got all the strings of our alphabet that aren't in our language. Okay, so the negation or complement of a regular language is also a regular language. And this time, it's most easy to convince yourself of that by thinking about DFAs. Because if you've got a DFA for the language, all you need to do to get a DFA for the complemented language is to change all the accepting states into rejecting states and all the rejecting states into accepting states. And because it's a DFA, your string will always end you up somewhere, so this will accept it exactly those strings that weren't accepted before. So you can see by just moving around between NFAs and DFAs, we can do a lot. So this means languages for patterns could be even richer than the language that I've given.
because we could in principle include operators for intersection and complement in this sort of language. In practice, that's not often done, partly because if you want to use negation, for instance, then you really do need to convert to a DFA. You really do get hit by the exponential blow-up in that case. So you can do it in principle. But the thing to ponder, just to sort of convince yourself we have actually done something interesting, is we know now that if L is defined by a regular expression, then so is its complement. Because you can convert L into an NFA and then into a DFA, take its complement, convert it back to a regular expression. Try and think how you convince yourself of that directly just by thinking of regular expressions. It's not so easy. Okay, so just 10 minutes now to tell you about the other application of regular languages I want to draw your attention to. And this is the problem of lexical analysis for formal languages. So the idea is we're trying to process something in a formal language, a programming language like Java. And the first thing we want to do is we've got a stream of characters, which is our raw input, the source file you write. And the first thing we want to do is to sort of split this up into the minimal meaningful units that form part of the Java programming language. So, for example, here's a bit of Java, believe it or not, which I've deliberately, annoyingly written without any spaces in it at all. Okay, that's not just to make it hard to read. It's to make the point that a Java compiler, if you gave it this, it would actually know how to split it up into these things here, which are the sort of what are called the lexical tokens, or the minimal meaningful units that compose the Java program. So these are of various kinds. Some of these are keywords or reserved words of the language, like while, and some of them are special symbols like brackets and things. And then some of them are, we've got whole classes of possible tokens. So this count two, it's an identifier. So this is a sequence of symbols which in Java it's possible to use as a variable name, not only as a variable name, but also as a class name, a method name, various other things. So there's a whole class of things in Java called identifiers, and lexical analysis will involve noticing that an identifier can consist of both alphabetical characters and digits, and so count two in this context is itself a single identifier. We've got these two symbols belonging together as a single operation, less than or equals. We've got four digit symbols there, which it notices are all grouped together into a single integer. This is an integer literal, so a number of thousand occurring as an integer in your program, and so on, an assignment operator, and there. So we want to not only chop our input up into the relevant lexical tokens, but we also want to classify these tokens into what kind they are. So we want to notice that count two is a certain kind of token called an identifier, whereas 1,000 is a certain kind of token called an integer literal. Okay, and various other special symbols maybe have their own kind of token. So that's the problem we're trying to address. And that's obviously something we need to do as a first stage in processing language. Okay, and the idea is that so the output from the lexing phase, that stream of tagged tokens that I gave, each tagged according to their type, the output from lexing is going to serve as the input to the parsing phase. So parsing is the stage where we take this stream of tokens and we try and arrange them together into a nice tree structure, giving the syntax tree, and that's what we'll be talking about later in the course. The idea is what we get as the output from lexing is everything we need as input for parsing. So the point is that from a parsing point of view, there are infinitely many possible tokens in Java, but we can lump together tokens like 100 and 1,000. We can treat, from the point of view of parsing, we can treat these as basically the same, because we can lump them together in the same class of integer literals. Because the point is that wherever the literal 100 can legitimately appear in a Java program, so can 1,000. So the parser doesn't care what integer literal we have at this point. It only cares that we have an integer literal. So that's why we do this tagging. And so now each lexical token gets assigned a class. And special keywords in the language, such as while, normally get a lexical class to themselves, because the parser does need to know that while is while, not that, you know, as distinct from if or then or any other keyword of Java. And special symbols like brackets often get lexical classes themselves. And another thing we want Alexa to do is to throw away the white space and comments. Okay, so we've just got this stream of tokens ready for parsing. Okay. Useful rule of thumb is that the boundaries between lexemes, I wrote it there without spaces, but the lexeme boundaries here are the places where you could harmlessly insert a space without affecting the meaning. Okay, so now enter regular languages, because in most computer languages, such as Java, the allowable forms for the various kinds of lexical tokens that there are, so we've got identifiers, integer literals, floating point literals, and also things like comments and things that we're not that bothered about. The allowable forms for each of these things are fairly simple, and in fact they're simple enough to be described using our technology of regular expressions. They're regular languages. So that means that we can use the theory we've developed as a means of generating efficient lexing programs, so programs for lexing a given Java source program. But it's even better than that. We not only have a theory that lets us create a lexer, but if you're designing a language for some purpose, which some of you may well end up doing at some point, you don't actually need even to write the lexer yourself. All you need to do is you need to write down some regular expressions for the various kinds of lexical tokens that your language has in mind. So you need to decide what you want to count as what you want to allow as identifiers in your language, what you want to allow as integer literals, what keywords you want to allow, and so on. You just sort of list all those, type them all in a file, and then you let the machine automatically generate the code for your lexer. So you don't need to implement the lexer. You just write a specification using regular expressions of what the lexical tokens of your language are, and the machine will do the rest. And this is the idea behind programs called lexer generators. So a lexer generator is a program that will write a lexer for you, given a specification of your lexical tokens. And then a lexer is a program you can run on a source file, and it'll actually do the lexing. Okay, so here's a little example taken from a lexer generator called JFlex. This is a sort of Java-based tool, and this is a bit of a description of some of the kinds of lexical tokens you get in Java. So this says, for example, an identifier in Java can consist of, and here we've got some predefined sets of characters. So this means a Java letter followed by any number, zero or more Java letters or digits, okay? So a Java, so you can have just a single letter, and that's a valid identifier in Java. Or you can have something like catch 22, but you can't have 22 catch, okay? You can't have that one. You have to start with a letter, and then you can have as many zero letters or digits as you like. So here's just a little regular expression which defines the possible forms of identifiers in that we could allow. Okay. Actual identifiers in Java can allow a bit more than this, but I won't go into that. And then here, for integer literals, an integer literal can either be just a zero by itself, or it can be a sequence of digits where the leading digit is a non-zero digit, and then we've got zero or more, possibly zero digits, okay? So this lets us write things like 0 and 1 and 15 and 10. But we can't write 0, 5 in Java. In most languages, that's not allowed as a way of writing 5. So a zero at the beginning is only allowable if that's all that you're writing, okay? So there's a little regular expression for defining integer literals. And then here's a certain kind of comment. So here's a these comments in Java which begin with a double slash and go on to the end of, until the end of the line. So an end of line comment takes the form of a double slash followed by zero or more input characters. These are ordinary characters there, followed by a line terminator character. Okay, so we can just write ourselves some regular expressions, and then we write a list of kind of actions for the Lexer to perform. And this basically says, if you see one of these, do this. And these are, as we'll see in a minute, these are listed in a certain order of priority. So it says, if you see the string while, that means the keyword while. So that means return the current symbol tagged as a thing of class while. So this capital while there is meant to be a name for the lexical class that this belongs to. So these things basically just mean tag the token in question as being of a certain lexical class. And if you see something that has the form of an identifier, tag it as an identifier. Now you'll notice that the string while itself has the form of an identifier in the sense that it matches this pattern. But we want a while to be treated as the keyword while, not as an identifier while. So these are listed in a sort of order of priority here,
and it's going to take the first applicable one
to label your lexical token with. Okay? If you see a decimal integer literal, then return it as this. If you see this double equals thing, return it as an assignment operator. If you see an end of line comment, just don't do anything with it. Just don't return it. Just pass over it silently. But we need to know what counts as an end of line comment in order to be able to throw it away. So you write a source file consisting of some stuff like this. So this basically is a sort of description of what your how the lexical structure of your language is supposed to work. You type something like that, hit a button, it creates a lexer for you, which you can then go and run. Okay, I'm enjoying this so much that I've not noticed I've reached the end of the lecture. So we've just got, three more slides there. I wonder if I'll go through this whole course without ever catching up with my... So there's a sort of invariant that there always seems to be three slides left. However many or few slides I have, I really thought I was going to catch up today, but I didn't. So catch up next time and do some natural language processing applications as well. Enjoy your weekend. Thank you. Hmm.